1 year ago, I testified before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations as Intel's executive responsible for export controls. It was a moment that brought together everything I'd learned about risk, responsibility, and the real-world impact of compliance decisions. This podcast series is an extension of that experience. It's about making sense of export controls, where they come from, where they are now, and how we navigate what's next. Whether you're a practitioner, policymaker, or just curious about how global trade intersects with national security, this series is for you. Welcome to episode 18 of Written Reflections, a forum for addressing the dynamic, complex, and essential nature of cross-border trade in our ever-changing world, and an opportunity to reflect on some of life's most important issues in a world of incredible uncertainty and unpredictability. Today, I begin a three-part series exploring the past, the present, and future of export controls. A system shaped by history, it's driven by geopolitics, and constantly evolving. I'm joined by Bruce Jackson, a longtime practitioner and friend whose depth of experience spans government, industry, and the multilateral frameworks that define this space. Bruce has not only witnessed the evolution of export controls, he's helped shape how companies and policymakers respond to it. In this first episode, we'll trace the long, strange trip from the Cold War's COCOM era to post-Berlin Wall rewrites, from the rise of sanctions to satellite liberalization, and into the regulatory shifts of the past two administrations, including Huawei, Russia, and semiconductors. Whether you're a compliance professional, a policymaker, or you're simply trying to make sense of this complex regime, our goal is to give you the historical grounding and strategic insight to navigate what's next. So let's dive in. Bruce, welcome to Written Reflections.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I am so glad to be having this discussion with you at a time like this. To start with, why don't you go ahead and give our listeners a brief overview of your history in export controls? You know, how'd you get started, Bruce? What are some of your key career moments, and what are you doing now?
Yeah, so I've been in export controls, kind of stumbled into it. I was fresh out of college, was an intern on Capitol Hill for a little bit, and just happened to stumble into the Department of Commerce one day looking for a job. And was in the personnel department. This is back in the day when you can walk in without security or anything. You just kind of late in the day, and was made aware of a position in what was then known as Exporter Services. I think it still is within the Office of Export Administration, OEA. It was part of the International Trade Administration at that time. And interviewed some weeks later after applying, and ended up in the Exporter Services team there at OEA. And it was interesting what kind of happened to me then was that, and then this is kind of just a fun story, that I one day was working the phone lines and got a call out of the blue from someone I recognized who spoke Swedish. And they were speaking English, but I could tell the accent. And it was someone from the U.S. Embassy in Stockholm. And I thought, well, gosh, I know they're a Swede. So, and since I'd studied abroad, I'd been abroad, and I'd studied university in Sweden and high school. I'd been exchanged to speak Swedish. So I just answered in Swedish. And I could tell through the phone that this person was like, what? I call the U.S. government, and they answer me in my language. It was complete, I think, serendipity for them. And little did I know the influence that would have, that moment would have on the rest of my career. Because the next thing you know, I'm getting calls from Sweden all the time, from Swedish exporters, because this was during the Reagan administration, and you had a lot of concerns about the neutral states of Europe with products and technologies going through the neutral states that didn't really have robust export control systems, and those products ending up in Warsaw Pact countries. And the Reagan administration was kind of putting their thumb down on some of these neutral states, Sweden, Switzerland, Austria, Finland, and so. And little did I know that as a young punk, I was getting thrown into that. But so I ended up with, a year later, I was working for a law firm in D.C. that had a lot of Scandinavian clients. And then 4 years later, one of those clients hired me to move to Europe 3 weeks after the Berlin Wall came down. And so then I moved to Germany. And I was there during the whole transition from, the Cold World, environment to the more of the multilateral Wassenaar world and all of that, which we're going to talk about. But and I ended up staying in Germany 10 years. So who knew? Never planned to do that. But that was kind of a big deal. And then I eventually was working for a big Swiss-Swedish engineering company at the time. And then I moved back to the States, ended up in Colorado, and worked in consulting, did a lot of work for consulting companies, and then eventually went to work Virgin Galactic. So I was head of trade controls there for a while. And then later on, ended up going back and going into another aerospace company, a British aerospace company, and then after that into semiconductors, where is where I'm sitting now. So that's kind of a very rapid overview of kind of my trajectory in this field.
Wow, thanks for sharing that. I have to kind of chuckle because you and I kind of got started around the same time, and I stumbled in it as well. I needed a job, and there was an ad for a clerk, and I found out that meant submitting export license, and I had no idea. All I knew about was driver's licenses and export licenses. So same thing. I started way back in that same time frame, and I remember my first event I was invited to. I went to. There was a discussion led by a gentleman named Ian Baird, and I believe that you worked for Ian at the time, and you were there. Sure. Yeah. I remember yeah. You were a tall, skinny guy, wavy blonde hair.
Not and so I remember, much anymore.
I never forget that. I remember meeting you then, and we've crossed paths. In fact, today, currently, we both serve on the RAPTAC, which is the Technical Advisory Committee to the BIS, to the Department of Commerce, and we have a lot of fun trying to navigate these rules in that context as well. So, the first part of this series, Bruce, we're going to do a series, and I really appreciate you being willing to meet three different times to talk about this topic. We probably could meet for the rest of the year and talk about this. There's so much. But this particular first part of the series, I'm calling The Long Strange Trip. And it really is, it's been like a trip. I mean, it's if you think about any trip, you want to go back and look at the beginning. How did it start, right? And export controls is not new. I mean, they've been around a very long time. And I think it'd be good to maybe help the listeners understand how did they get started, and what was the original intent of export controls? I think this was during the Cold War, but what was the intent?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking back to all the training and education I've done on the topic of export controls. And I actually start much earlier. I start centuries ago.
Okay.
Go back to the Middle Ages and things like crossbows were controlled for export. Because if you had your little kingdom, the crossbow anybody could use as opposed to a longbow, and the crossbows had an advantage. You could arm all your peasants with them or whatever, And that obviously created an advantage, and you didn't want your enemy to get them. So, I mean, you go back to, and then gunpowder, think about gunpowder, think about other things that have happened through the ages. So export controls aren't new. So when people think they're new, no, they've been around forever, centuries, Yes. So that's really the point of that is to help educate people on that. But in the modern context, really, I think it's after World War II with the formation of the Coordinating Committee for Multilateral Export Controls that was founded in Paris in 1949. Was kind of the modern start of it, and it was a focus on basically national security and foreign policy reasons from a U.S. perspective, but clearly driven by the U.S. in the post World War II environment, the U.S. was kind of the dominant power in many respects, in most respects, in fact, but there were big concerns about the Soviet Union and the communist world, so to say, and so as a result of that. the U.S. and its allies implemented a set of controls to try to maintain that technological edge over the Warsaw Pact. And that was really the foundational aspect of it. And the U.S. was the big driver then. And one key element that COCOM had when it was formed was this kind of veto concept, where only, you know, you couldn't approve a transaction or do something if another country within that regime agreed with it. So that was kind of a powerful tool, useful tool during those years. But again, it was largely U.S. driven. A lot of the key technologies were in the U.S., so it kind of worked for a while. But as things evolved, we'll talk about that later. That kind of started to break down a little bit. But yeah, that's kind of how I view it. I mean, it's instrumental. There have been interesting cases during that era as well. You know, obviously I was pretty young. I wasn't involved in those early days at all. Although we know someone who was, don't we?
We do.
So we've got some, there's at least one practitioner out there who's been in, who can say, yeah, I was there when, you know, those kinds of things were happening. So, but yeah, that's kind of my what I would say about that.
Yeah. Well, just to give the listeners a sense of what we're talking about is there is a gentleman that sits on the RAP. Well, he's not actually officially on the RAP tech. He used to be. And he's the person you're referring to. His name is Bill Root. I'll just go and call him out because he's really just this iconic person who's been involved, as you said. And I believe he this year became 102 years old and he still submits comments to the changing regulations. So really, amazing to have that historical context. So let's kind of jump into something because we're going to talk about how these controls have shifted over time. But back during the Cold War, there was one particular case that really kind of rocked the world of export controls. It involved an export control violation, and it involved a company in Japan, Toshiba Machine, and a company in Norway called Kongsberg. I'm going to try to pronounce this, Våpenfabrik. Hopefully I got that. And they are in Norway. And so these companies sold advanced multi-axis machine tools and numerical control systems to the Soviet Union. This was a technology that allowed the Soviet Union to produce quieter submarine propellers. And it was a violation. It was contrary to what COCOM had agreed should be controlled. So, Can you share some thoughts about, you know, why this was so consequential at that time?
Yeah, it was a big case. It was a big incident, and to be clear, it may have been a violation. It wasn't a violation of U.S. export controls. It was of COCOM, but these were non-U.S. technologies. The restrictions were on, it was really a violation of both Norway and Japan's export controls, and so. It had significant impact, however, on NATO because this particular transaction allowed the Soviets to make their submarines quieter. It basically reduced the cavitation of the propellers on the submarines so they were harder to hear. Suddenly, we couldn't hear them anymore. The NATO sonar pickets across the North Atlantic suddenly couldn't hear the Soviet submarines. So that became a big concern. And when this was discovered in the, I think it was 1987 or so, 86, 87, when it really broke, probably there were others who knew about it before then. I don't know the details there, but, you know, from my own experience, because I remember sitting in the Senate Banking Committee meetings when they were working on an omnibus trade bill in 88, which included the sanctions targeting Toshiba and Kongsberg. I mean, this was a big deal. I mean, you had people in Congress out on the steps of the Capitol or on the lawn smashing Toshiba radios. I mean, it was a really, really big deal. But and the sanctions that ended up in the legislation, the Omnibus Trade Act, these were basically punitive because there was no violation of U.S. rules. But even aside from that, these were aimed at these companies. And I think that was a significant lesson to non-U.S. companies that even if we don't violate U.S. law, we can be punished anyway, right? And so I moved to Europe right around that time and was working for a non-U.S. company. And this lesson was what everybody was talking about, not just within the company I work with, but with other companies, just kind of going, whoa, we've got to be really, really careful here. We have to decide what our is a concept I use, space of freedom, kind of what,
right,
how much latitude do we have to do this? Can we just follow our own rules and not worry about anything else? And that's one thing, one of the big lessons I've learned, and it'll probably come up in our discussions, you know, during this session as well as the forthcoming ones, is, you know, I've seen it repeatedly where the left hand does something and the right hand ends up paying for it because of, you know, these kinds of issues. And you look at it, Toshiba had a big contract with the Pentagon at that time. I think they may have lost that for sale of laptops and computers. I don't know. I don't recall all the specifics, but it was a big impact. And the U.S. government and NATO estimated that it would cost them billions to be able to catch up again, to be able to hear. You'd be able to, you know, they was going to require installation of more sonar buoys or whatever the technology was they were going to use to detect these submarines. So it was a big deal. And obviously it impacted these companies. Toshiba took actions against employees and leaders. And also you had, because I think it was Toshiba Machine Corporation that was involved in this, a subsidiary. And then in Kongsberg also, these companies had to revise their programs and all that. And even the countries had to, then the governments and the exporting authorities had to look at how they were managing it. So I think there was a real impact there in terms of its longer term impact in terms of the reach of U.S. jurisdiction.
It clearly was a wake-up call to the exporting community around the world, right? And I think we will talk about this over the three-part series, but, you know, we'll see this extraterritoriality authority surface in many instances, like Huawei, like semiconductors and other strategic tech transfers. So this will be a topic. So I think it's important that we kind of parked on this a little bit and talk about it. But let's move out of the Cold War, because even though today feels a little bit like we're back in the Cold War, but let's move out, because the Berlin Wall fell. You said you were there. I went across that wall, so I've seen it. It came down. But when the Berlin Wall fell, how did that kind of reshape the diversion landscape? And what sort of new risks came about as a result?
Okay. So, yeah, I moved, as I said previously, I moved to Germany just three weeks after the Berlin Wall came down. I have a few pieces of the wall somewhere laying around here. We had a lot, the company I worked for had a lot of joint ventures in Eastern Europe. And so the big concern initially was, okay, we now are going to share some technologies, because again, COCOM still existed, but it was kind of like, what are we going to do with COCOM now that, you know, the Cold War is kind of over or ending. And so with the shift to the East, the concern was all the things, the Wild East, you know, of Eastern Europe, that you're going to share technology, you're going to upgrade your joint ventures and companies you've acquired. There were lots of companies involved there. I can remember sitting in Prague in a hotel restaurant for breakfast and meeting people who worked for other companies, multilateral companies, multinational companies that had come to Prague to meet with their joint ventures or recently acquired companies to manage various aspects, to train them, to educate them on Western management practices and do things like what I was doing, was training them on export control. No, you can't keep selling that to Cuba. You can't keep shipping that to Libya. No, we're going to stop. So it was a lot about technology going west to east and then the fears of it going south. Right. So going to other parts of the world that maybe, you know, to countries that were in the Comic-Con world, in the Warsaw Pact sphere of influence that were beneficiaries of any trade. I mean, if you look back on countries that were subject to U.S. embargoes back in the 80s, those countries were often trading partners with Russia or with the Soviet Union at the time, and we're getting technologies from Eastern Europe. Those were things they could get. And, you know, we didn't want to find ourselves in that supply chain. So a big focus was on like cutting off that flow to the south and trying to mitigate that to some degree. And also what to do in this world. I mean, I can remember going to a meeting outside Paris. I think a French company had hosted it. And they had gathered they had some government people and private sector people there to talk about what a future regime might look like. And you could see, I mean, and I knew this too from all my visits, because I would go around to countries in Eastern Europe, but also in other parts of the European Union, and meet and do compliance meetings. And we would invite in someone from the local government authority. So you'd go to Portugal, or you go to Spain, or you go to the Czech Republic or Hungary, and you'd invite in someone from that administry, because I'd say, look, I want them to come in and educate the local team on what the local laws are and regulations. But one thing I learned, particularly, especially in those early days, was that the reaction was typically, oh, you don't, you guys are way ahead of us, is what the government people would say. You're way ahead of us. You've got a program. You're managing it. You're doing fine, which was great. It's a nice lesson to say. But it shows how nascent and how early they were in getting things set up. But it also laid the foundations for the need of something like Wassenaar. So.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, thinking about the 90s, because that's really post-Berlin Wall, right?
Yeah.
The
yeah.
90s, there were a lot of things that really happened in the world of export controls. I mean, I was just getting started, you know, and I knew how to practice with the way the regs were written. And then all of a sudden there was this news that we heard that they were going to do a complete rewrite of the regulations. And a lot of that was, I think, probably being motivated because of the change in the, you know, post-Cold War. And I remember when the new EIR rewrite came out, everybody was so worried, you know, to understand what had changed. And I remember I went through that entire rewrite chapter by chapter so that I could understand. And it did, it completely changed. But do you have any thoughts on, from your experience, how did that rewrite impact exporters?
Well, yeah, one other thing we should mention that happened in the lead up to that rewrite and basically the formation of Wassenaar was the Gulf War, the first one, right? And the concerns about technology that ended up in the Middle East and how do we stem that? Because it's not enough to control it from the Western countries. You had to have others involved in that and aligned with that. So I think that helped with the foundation there. But there was a recognition, I think, based on my interactions from sitting in Germany and interacting with people at BIS and others, that they needed a new way or a more expansive way to manage it. And that may have been something, I mean, I wasn't involved in I wasn't sitting in government, I was in private industry, so I didn't know exactly what was, you know, how the negotiations were going there. But I think the U.S., by really being willing to adopt the EU proposal for the structure for a multilateral control list, which was really the foundation that became the Wassenaar list. I think that was a way of bringing other countries into the fold and agreeing to how we manage things. It allowed still for unilateral controls. You could still do that. So that was good, but it also tried to expand the scope and get greater alignment. And so I think that was a key driver. The rewrite of the EAR, it changed the structure completely. For those who were experienced practitioners, it was a little annoying because we already knew where to go to find things, and suddenly they were moving things around and requiring you to go through these steps in the EAR now that they didn't have before. They were changing the control list completely. They had a completely different nomenclature, so that was something to learn. They created the de minimis rule as part of that. They had a parts and components rule before that, but they now had a de minimis rule. That's where that came to the fore, as well as deemed export requirements, really understanding that, you know, the sharing of technology with a foreign person was like an export to their home, was deemed an export to their home country. So, I mean, I think those kinds of things were really consequential. It also led to just conceptually, the expectations around a compliance program, because you had that coming out of the 90s, which was, you know, standards for what a compliance program would have, the accountability that they expect of companies to take in that arena. I think all those things kind of contributed to a more robustness. I think I do recall a lot of concerns around how are we going to manage technology controls? How are we going to, I think there was concern with technology that things were just going to explode and it was going to be hard to manage and track all of that. Well, we now know different, right? It actually, yep. Enforcement yep. has actually found it probably quite easy to go chase things down because of technology. So the fears, yes, there are those fears, but I think those are some big things I think that came out of the the EAR rewrite. And I will say that BIS, or at that time it was still BXA, BXA officials, and BXA was created right at the towards the end of my time there. But I think there was a recognition of the need to involve industry. And so while I was sitting in Germany, I was getting calls from BIS officials that were or BXA officials that were working on the rewrite to get ideas around different topics, where particularly around re-export controls, right? What, you know, those kind of things, some of the definitional things. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think for, as a practitioner, it was annoying, but at the same time, it was done in such a way that it made a lot of sense compared to what was before.
Right.
And I think, you know, we may talk about this later, but I almost feel like we are at such a, we've changed so much how export controls are managed today that we've piled onto this regulation that probably needs another rewrite. And it certainly would probably make our lives more simple, because some of the rules today are so complex the way they're written. But that could be a discussion for another time.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Let's make sure we talk about that, because I agree with you. Yes.
Yes, I think it's time. I mean, it's gotten so complex. And that was probably, I think, part of the impetus before. I'll also say, you know, you brought up deemed exports. And I have such a love-hate relationship with that, because I, you know, when that rule got published, you know, we had, at that time I was at Intel, we had to go scour the entire database of employees to find out who was working as under a visa. And then we had to submit, you know, their information to BXA. And in those days, they had you submit it on a carbon copy license application that you used a typewriter to type. And if you messed up somebody's name from a different company, it was, you had to get the little white thing and, you know, cause it was a carbon copy. I can't tell you how many times I had to rip that thing out and do it over. And then when you continued on, you had a license number, but the number was for the company. It wasn't for the individual originally. And so you had to just keep adding individuals. Eventually we got to the point where you would probably have a license per individual. But anyway, it's interesting. The deemed export has been an interesting, you know, practice. And I think you and I in the RapTech are working a lot on this, trying to figure out how can we help BIS be more address deemed exports in a much, much better way. So.
No, it's challenging too, because once you get your license, that's just the tip of the iceberg. You have to manage it, and you have to, and that's where breakdowns occur. Having been a consultant and done audits and assessments of companies and their compliance programs, license management is a gap. And we can see that in all the consent agreements that have occurred over the decades. that's often where the breakdown is managing the licenses.
Yeah. And that's a great lead in to, you know, to talking about kind of post 90s here. There was a surge in consent agreements, and, you know, how did these change the compliance landscape for exporters from your recollection?
Yeah. So, kind of thinking back a little bit into the latter half of the 90s for a little bit. I mean, that's also with the rise of a lot of trade sanctions. The Iran issues, there were a number of executive orders that came out about Iran. There was the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act. There was the Helms-Burton Act targeting Cuba. There were counter-blocking sanctions imposed by other countries, EU and Canada and whatnot. And you also, and because of the concerns about this, the need for more expansive compliance programs within companies was very important. And of course, the fiascos over technology leakage from the satellite industry, when the U.S. government decided to put certain space commercial satellite related technologies back under the EAR, basically under the Commerce Department and away from the State Department, taking out of the ITAR, and then you had these launch failures that happened in China. And as a result, there was sharing of information between the provider of the launch service versus the one who had the payload, and the oversharing of data to do the failure analysis and all of that, things that were not licensed and approved by the government, and that led to investigations and ultimately to guidance to be given to industry, because there weren't good companies, yay, we got this jurisdiction, we can do it ourselves now, and then they don't manage it right. Right. And so that's what really led to a lot of the guidelines that were issued, and those consent agreements were instructive, because each consent agreement, you could go through it and see, okay, what are they telling companies to do? What did the companies agree to do? Oh boy, we have to fold that into our program, because if we get caught, you know, or if we have an issue, we want to be able to say we're addressing it, try to mitigate that. And that's when you had the Nunn-Wolfowitz report come out, where they surveyed a bunch of companies. You had the Cox report that came out about the whole issue with China. Those are things people can go and Google and look up and get the background on it. But if you look at the tenets of Nunn-Wolfowitz, the key compliance program guidelines, over time there, around the end of the 90s and into the early parts of this century, you started to see those things crop up in national guidelines that were issued by, you know, well, the State Department has its guidelines, BIS has its guidelines, now the EMS guidelines, which are in need of updating, by the way. So you've got all these guidance, and then other countries would do the same thing. I can remember building charts listing, well, do they require corporate policy statement? Do they require record keeping? What are the rules? And of course, none of these really at that time addressed the internet and AI and those kinds of things, which we need to deal with today. But this was the start of it. So it was really, those consent agreements laid the ground foundation for it. But I will say one thing I want to say about consent agreements, I think it's important, is, you know, having been involved in a couple of them, usually as a consultant helping companies implement the corrective actions, you know, this is an area, once you've completed all the things you're supposed to do, and the government says to you, you're good to go, you've ticked all the boxes, you've taken care of things, I am concerned. I've seen habits, because you see repeat consent agreements from the same company, and you go, like, did they learn their lesson? Not really. And you know, you got different people involved, different areas of the business. People are human. They make mistakes. That's what happens. But you also see in companies where as soon as they get clear of that consent agreement, they start cutting people. They go right back to old behaviors. Then they complain next time they have another restriction that comes in. So part of this is, I think, a matter of, it's kind of part of my ethos. Yeah. Own it. Yeah. Compliance is a strategic, can be a strategic advantage.
Absolutely.
Absolutely can be. Because a lot of times when I speak with executive leadership teams, when I've been involved in this, and this goes back decades, okay, I'll bring up an issue. A senior leader, a CEO, CFO, the chief counsel, other key leaders will say to me, oh, no one else is bringing this up. Like, it's not really a compliance question you're bringing up, but I'm glad you brought it up. And I'm like, okay, so maybe we have a reason here to raise this, because other teams are not bringing up some of these things. And so I think that is a key lesson, too, coming out of the consent agreements. I mean, we saw the DOJ, the sentencing guidelines, that also has been expanded, and you know, that is something to be included in your compliance program. You need to be able to address that, because you know, there could be consequences from that.
But one of the realities of that time frame, Bruce, was the people in a company that were responsible for trade were kind of off in a corner somewhere, you know, kind of buried under something, and just make sure nothing bad happens, right? And there were much more bigger issues for companies. And I think when something bad happened, all of a sudden it did get elevated up to the right levels. And then, of course, people took action. But as soon as, like you said, that all got resolved back down into the, I mean, that has been my experience. And I think today we're living in a time where I think it's obvious companies cannot ignore trade. It's gotten to that level, and so I think there's a lot more attention, which is good. You know, another thing you mentioned about the transfer of items from the State Department, the ITAR, over to the EAR, I don't think we can go further without mentioning encryption. I mean, encryption was huge. I mean, it was controlled under the ITAR, and they moved it onto the CCL. And now all of a sudden, everybody, because of the birth of the internet and of security, everybody had security and everything. Encryption became dominant. I mean, I know as running a compliance group, that seems like that's all we worried about was complying with the encryption rules, getting the CCATs in, you know, doing the reporting and so on. So I think encryption was another area that really kind of blossomed in the early 2000s.
When I first moved, I was in Germany in 1990 and early 90s. And at that point, corporate email was not that prevalent, right? It was faxes. They were faxing everything.
Yes.
And so on one of my trips back to the U.S., because I was living in Germany, but I could come back to the U.S., so I could come back for holiday or for meetings. And at one point, I went into a Circuit City electronics store, and I was going to buy a copy of Delrina's WinFax application, and I could use that. So I had a computer, but we really didn't have email yet, but I could use that for sending faxes. But I took the package off the shelf, and there was a sticker on it that said, "Not for export from the U.S., subject to ITAR." So, seriously. It was crazy. So yes, I didn't export that, but that's how it was back then. Yeah. Of course, now it's a totally different situation, but, and the challenge with encryption is that we've got rules that we have to deal with. And the problem is the U.S. has implemented it's complex. It's not easy to necessary for someone new to the novice to really get it, but the license exception ENC and the mechanisms that you have under the EAR to manage and export that works, but they don't have that in other allied countries. They don't have that mechanism. Yeah. And they take a very critical review of it. But encryption is so pervasive. It's so critical to protect our personal data today and to protect everything that you want everybody to have it. You just want to know who has what. Yes. So in times of conflict, when you need to try to do something about it, you know where it is. And that's what the legacy we're dealing with now, all the reporting requirements and everything, at least from a U.S. perspective. And this does pose a lot of challenges, no question.
Yeah. And I think you're right. It's become less of a control and more of an information gathering exercise, as you say. And I think, you know, if we kind of shift a little bit into the 2000s, you know, I would say maybe up to 2016, when you think about the world of export controls, I mean, in my mind, it was really a series of rules and relaxations that tried to help exporters, you know, export around the world. I mean, it was globalization. Everybody wanted to move things around the world easily. And so BIS came out with license exceptions that you could apply. Trusted programs like the VEU, which is a validated end user. So you trust the exporter to be able to do the compliance checks and you allow them to go forward. You know, maybe bulk deemed export licenses, so making it more simple to be able to have people at your companies, you know, have access. You know, there was routine relaxation under Wassenaar controls. I mean, every time we had a Wassenaar proposal, it usually was trying to remove something from the list, right?
Right.
So we went through this time, I think, of relaxation, of making it easier for exporters to be able to export. And then, you know, there was the entity list that was born during that time frame as well. And it was really originally put forward as a way to notify a company, hey, we suspect you're not doing the right things. Please come, you're on a list now until you can come back and show us that you're doing everything right. So it was more about a goal of changing behavior and less about being, you know, punitive in terms of the entity.
I mean, my recollection, it was really a outgrowth of EPSI, the Enhanced Proliferation Control Initiative under the, I think that was wasn't that Bush administration? I mean, it was a long time ago. I mean, I've been in this so long. And EPSI really, I mean, the entity list was really, it's just how it's been used really changed under the first Trump administration. I mean, it was not, you put people on the list because of concerns about proliferation. Yeah. Concerns.
Diversion.
I mean, those were the parties that were on the diversion proliferation concerns.
Yep.
And now it's morphed into being used to just, you know, putting anyone on there
the naughty list
for other reasons. The naughty list, even if they haven't violated anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. They might. So let's.
They might though. So let's put them on the list. Which, I mean, I'm not judging that. I mean, we were living with it, right?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, there was. You know, so it's something it has changed. I'm sure there were others out there, even a lot of practitioners who've been here a long time are probably would have the same comments that I have about it. But I mean, it's something we have to deal with. And there U.S. export controls are pervasive. And so companies want to comply with them, particularly multilateral, larger companies trying to deal with things. So yeah, no, it's the Entity List is here to stay. I mean, it's growth. I mean, I'm shocked at it. I mean, it's not a, but it's not a cat we can put back in the bag. It's not going to work. No. So.
No, I think when it first started, I think you could count maybe the number of entities, maybe on with your 10 fingers and thumbs in mine.
Right.
Now I think I saw somewhere it's over 3,000. I mean, it's just incredible. So,
and with the issuance of the recent affiliates rule, that has exponentially grown in terms of the focus there.
Yeah, and we'll talk about a little bit more about this when we get into more of the current situation. But, you know, moving kind of forward, you know, you mentioned the Trump administration, but let's think about Trump 1 and Biden. Because in my mind, I clearly saw and have seen a shift in how in the tone and the strategy of BIS when it comes to export controls. Any insights into how would you characterize those that shift that we're seeing?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the foreign produced direct product rule. I always say foreign produced because that's kind of what it is, but FPDR. Not just foreign direct, but foreign produced direct product rule. And that rule changed significantly. I mean, that over the last, it started with the, you know, with, I guess Huawei was the focus there. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's interesting. I think that works for some product and technology areas, but doesn't necessarily work for others. It works for semiconductors and that kind of technology, those kinds of technology integrated circuits, because U.S. technology in that supply chain are so pervasive. Everybody's using them. And so you couldn't really, you know, avoid it. And so it made the rule effective, right? Uh-huh. And so that's a change, I think, over the last years. I mean, I think, and particularly because of the concerns about China and the rise of China in the last, you know, during the last decades, but especially an awareness now, you know, a lot of concern about China's ambitions, aspirations in certain corners. I mean, I'm not judging any of that. I mean, I'm just saying this is the world we have to deal with now. And and so trying to manage the compliance risks associated with that in a multilateral world. So, I mean, I don't have, a specific opinion on, you know, am I seeing a big change in these latest administrations? Because when I look back through history, I see, like, I've seen this in other areas as well. I mean, you could look at, again, the 90s and the concerns around sanctions and the concerns around aerospace and those kinds of things. And sometimes I think the changes are, change is going to happen. There are going to, you know, always be changes because of the geopolitical environment we're in, and you need to be prepared to be able to adapt to it. So,
I think that's well said. And from my perspective, I feel like in the 2000s, in a lot of ways, maybe as exporters, we might have been a little bit lulled to sleep in terms of just managing compliance. It was fairly routine. And then we got hit, and, you know, starting in 2016 with, I think, you know, some significant changes. And like you said, really trying to contain a technology from, you know, from China primarily. And I think that really was a challenge for BIS to come up with rules that actually were effective in doing that. And I think it's super challenging for exporters to try to understand and then how to build your programs around that to ensure compliance. So it's definitely, I think there's definitely been a much more greater focus in these past two administrations. You know, you mentioned Huawei.
Yeah.
We haven't really gotten into why. We can talk some more maybe in our next sessions a bit, because Huawei is just such a watershed moment, I think, if you go back to the May of 2019 entity listing, and there's been so much since then. But when we talked at the beginning, we talked about the the Toshiba Kongsberg case. And so do you see any parallels between the Huawei case
Absolutely.
And the extraterritorial moves we saw back then?
Absolutely. No, I mean, it is all about extraterritorial reach, right? It's about in the Toshiba Kongsberg case, you had violations that were not of U.S. export control laws, but of other countries' laws. But the U.S. punished those companies for violating their own laws. I mean, obviously you could argue it violated COCOM and what those requirements were, but it was clearly a extraterritorial reach action by the U.S. government. And then with Huawei, you're talking about a lot of activity that's happening outside the United States. Yes, they're using U.S. tooling. They may be using U.S. software to do some designs, but suddenly that extraterritorial reach through the foreign pretty strict product rules really did kind of clamp down on that and impact it. It worked because it's semiconductors. And I do think you're right. I mean, all the advanced semiconductor rules, the export controls of the last years, you know, that clearly has had a big impact on the industry. I have to admit, when I was coming to my current employer in the semiconductor industry, I was coming from aerospace and I was like, oh, this will be a sleepy job. How wrong was I? Wow. You know, it's just, but you're right. You'd gone to sleep to some degree in the industry because I don't want to overstate that, but you know, from my perspective, it was much more straightforward than aerospace when, you know, you're talking about launching rockets and it just, there's a lot of complexity there and missile technology control regime issues and all these other things that were kind of fun to deal with. But, I do see us as consequential. Here's a link. You're going to continue to see those kinds of things. We're going to talk hopefully about what we see looking in the crystal ball, what other actions you can see in this arena. And there will always be counteractions to try to work around it. I mean, with Huawei, and all the restrictions on, it's not just Huawei, it's other parties that are involved there. And there are, I hate to call them loopholes, but the way the rules are structured, you know, once you close off one avenue, it's like whack-a-mole. You have to look for other ways in which they're getting things. And it's not like someone intentionally created a loophole, created that. But, you know, when there's a desire to get access to a technology or capability, take AI, for example, let's say you cut off the ability to build an AI modeling solution and you found a way to rent space to use it on, you know, then you can, you go down that path. And so, so this is, it is whack-a-mole in many ways.
In many ways, I think that's a really good way to put it. You know, just to kind of, for our listeners to kind of bring some reality to how this all worked, I can tell you how I worked for a semiconductor company, a large one. And, you know, there was a time not long ago that the bulk of our work was submitting CCATs for encryption and submitting cookie cutter deemed export licenses. And so my licensing people they did that. But then you introduce this very complex semiconductor rule, the AI rules, and now all of a sudden a license became critical, how you wrote it up, what you actually asked for on the license, how much you asked for. All those things had huge, and also the Huawei situation, you know. And you know, when you submitted a license for Huawei, you had to be very careful, otherwise that thing will get stuck in a desk drawer somewhere and you'll never see it. So all of a sudden the work of an export compliance professional, especially in the licensing side, became very important, and it needed a new set of skills, right? Someone that could really look at things more strategically and think through the implications and how do I actually get this license, as opposed to just throwing the classifications. Anyway, that's just reality of how it worked. And we saw that play out. And I think today, I'm sure it's just the same. I mean, it takes a lot of work to be able to figure out how to get something approved.
Yeah, it's not only getting the approval. Once you get the approval, managing the requirements that whatever's been approved
come with it. Yes.
And I think the biggest problem from licensing perspective is you need some predictability. Right. Mm-hmm. With the tightening of policies, just presumption of denial policies on everything, you know, it makes it very difficult because, I mean, obviously maybe that's it. Well, that one could argue that's intentional. You know, why are you applying for this license when it's a presumption of denial? Well, you're trying to keep a customer happy that where some business can be done, but that subject to U.S. jurisdiction cannot. You got to be careful there, though, because again, it goes back to my argument that you don't want the left hand doing something the right hand's going to pay for, and trying to be mindful of those kinds of situations. But yeah, licensing and then the management of the licenses is critical, and you need predictability. You need rigor around, you know, you need to be able to count on that a decision will be made on your license by a certain date, and we haven't really seen that in the last decade. I mean, things have been like Yeah, it's very unpredictable, and that makes it very difficult to make a commercial business decision.
Absolutely. Well, that's good lead in to our next session, Bruce, because we'll talk a bit more about how to understand the regulations, how to turn them from being unpredictable to more predictable. And so there's a lot to talk about, as we know. Yeah. So I appreciate all your insights this time. I'm going to go ahead and just wrap up, and then we'll meet again next week. But let me just close by saying, you know, to our listeners, as you've seen, you know, export controls weren't born in a vacuum. They're the product of decades of policy, conflict, and adaptation. For compliance leaders, understanding that history isn't just academic, it's strategic. It helps us advise senior leadership, define our enterprise's space of freedom, and anticipate the next turn. In our next episode, we'll shift to the present, the realities of China, Russia, emerging technology, and the post-pandemic world. Stay with us. Until next time, take care.